This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam.
We have some pieces from Banana Republic.
Well, we need more, don't we? Oh.
There's a scene you might remember from the movie, The Devil Wears Prada.
Where are the belts for this dress? Why is no one ready?
Meryl Streep plays Miranda Priestly, the demanding editor-in-chief of a high-end fashion magazine. In this scene, she's having a hard time choosing between two belts that look nearly identical.
Here. They're so different.
Miranda's disheveled new employee, played by Anne Hathaway, watches with amusement.
Something funny?
No, you know, it's just that both those belts look exactly the same to me. You know, I'm still learning about this stuff and...
This stuff?
Miranda's eyes narrow.
Oh, okay. I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
And what Miranda says next offers a window into a kind of mental miscalculation that all of us make.
You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue. It's not turquoise. It's not lapis. It's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean...
Miranda goes on to list the unseen people who, in a way, chose that sweater for her.
Then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think
the trend drifted from the fashion houses to department stores.
And then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when, in fact, you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room. From a pile of stuff.
We like to think that we're independent thinkers, that the things we buy and the values we hold are driven by our personalities, not the whims or wishes of others. It turns out, reality is a bit more complicated. Everywhere in life, at work, at school, in a big stadium with thousands of other people, at home in the privacy of our own bedrooms, it turns out our behavior is shaped by the judgment, norms, and actions of other people. Sometimes we can feel these influences, but more often than not, we don't even notice their existence. This week on Hidden Brain, the subtle ways that social norms and peer pressure shape who we are. Some time ago, Jonah Berger was talking with a lawyer friend from Washington, D.C.
And I was telling them about social influence, and they were lamenting the impact of social influence on their peers. They were saying, God, you know, all D.C. lawyers are the same. They make it big. They, you know, they become partner, whatever it is. And they go out and they buy a new BMW. And I said, well, that's interesting. But, you know, aren't you a D.C. lawyer? I said to my friend. And, you know, don't you drive a BMW also? And he said, oh, yeah. But, you know, they all drive gray ones and I drive a blue one. and I was sitting there going, okay, I guess. But what I love about that story is two things, right? One, again, we see influence, right? My friend could see all the other people driving very similar cars, except when that light shone on his own behavior, he couldn't see it. Then it was invisible. There the influence was invisible. But second, it wasn't just about doing the same thing, right? It wasn't just about buying the exact same car, and it wasn't about being completely different. It's about being similar and different at the same time. And so there are many flavors of influence that often invisibly affect our behavior.
Jonah Berger is a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the book, Invisible Influence: The Hidden Forces That Shape Behavior. In it, he says that one of the great insights of social psychology is that we don't see ourselves as clearly as we see other people. We see the things we buy and the choices we make differently from the choices made by others.
And part of that is the access we have to the reasons that we bought things. So when we look around, we see lots of people doing similar things. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all pretty similar, right? Most of us are not like Lady Gaga walking around in a meat dress. Most of us are wearing, you know, shorts and t-shirts, jeans and a collared shirt. We're dressed pretty similarly. We drive similar cars. We buy similar things. And so indeed, when we look around, we see a lot of people acting similarly, and we see influence and assume it's happening. When we look to ourselves, though, we look to our introspections. We don't just say, well, what did I behave? What did I do? But we look for evidence that there's a reason that we behave that way. And because when we think about it, well, I don't think I bought that car to fit in. I wasn't sitting there going, God, I really want to keep up with the Joneses. You thought you bought it because of price, or you thought you bought it because you liked how it looked. So you don't think it affected your own behavior, even though at the end of the day, it actually did.
Companies often pay celebrities to hawk their merchandise. So I often see athletes wearing clothes with the Nike swoosh. Tiffany apparently once paid Anne Hathaway $750,000 to wear its jewelry at the Oscars. But a few years ago, you tell the story of how Abercrombie and Fitch made an unusual offer to the stars of Jersey Shore. What was that offer?
So you may remember the Jersey Shore, sort of a bunch of early 20s folks, lots of fake tanner and big muscles.
I was in the jacuzzi and clothes just started coming off. So we decided to have a little fun.
And one of them was a guy named Mike, the Situation Sorrentino, and he was called the Situation for his famous abs.
I mean, you can hate on me all you want to, but what can you possibly say to somebody that looks like Rambo pretty much with his shirt off?
And Abercrombie & Fitch sent him a letter offering to pay him money. And that by itself is not unusual, right? As you mentioned, product placement is a major thing that companies often use. What was interesting about this letter, though, was they weren't offering to pay him money to wear their clothes. They were actually paying him not to wear their clothes. And it turns out he wasn't the only Jersey Shore cast member who had a recent run-in with a brand. Another cast member, Snooki, she was the short one, you may remember, who's been termed as looking like a parking cone because she wore so much orange fake tanner. She got a free handbag in the mail. And obviously, again, sending a free handbag makes sense. Brands may want to send it to her because she shows up in People magazine or In Touch, and because she's wearing it, other people might wear the brand. Except she got a Gucci handbag not from Gucci, but one of their competitors. And so why would a competitor send her a free handbag? Why would Abercrombie & Fitch offer to pay Mike the Situation not to wear their clothes? And it turns out influence is very much like a magnet. We often think about it attracting, doing the same thing as others. But just that often it repels us and leads us to the opposite. And the idea here is, well, if Mike the Situation is wearing Abercrombie & Fitch, maybe other people aren't going to want to wear it anymore. Or if Snooki's hanging on to a Gucci handbag, maybe that'll help their competitors because no one will want to wear Gucci anymore. So we need to understand how social influence attracts, but also how it repels.
You and Chip Heath at Stanford University ran a similar experiment some years ago, and this one involved wristbands. Walk me through what you did and what you found.
This is one of my first studies that I ran early on in graduate school. You may remember these yellow Livestrong wristbands. They were for Lance Armstrong's Livestrong Foundation. And they came out. People were quite interested in them at the beginning. And we sold them to a group on campus. So we knocked on doors. We said, hey, we're raising money for cancer awareness. Will you buy one of these wristbands and wear it for a dollar? Most people said yes. They were more than happy to wear it. We followed up a week later to see if many people were wearing them. They were. So indeed, people were wearing the wristband. And then we did something interesting. We sold them to a dorm next door. And we wanted to see, similar to this example of Mike the Situation wearing Abercrombie or a Snooki carrying Gucci handbag, how would people feel when other people they didn't want to be associated with started wearing the bands? And so there's a dorm on Stanford campus, sort of known as the geeky dorm on campus. And basically, we went next door and we sold these wristbands to the geeks. And so the question was, what would those original wristband wearers do, the people that liked the wristband, that were wearing it all the time, do once the geeks started wearing it? And sure enough, as soon as the geeks started wearing it, about a third of the people in that initial group stopped wearing it. And they stopped because they didn't want to be associated with the geeks, right? Once those geeky folks were doing it, they didn't want to do it anymore.
So what you're really saying is that one really effective way to get people to buy your brand or buy your product is make sure that the people they despise are buying other brands. Is that what you're saying?
A little bit, yeah. We often think about sort of aspirational identities. So Abercrombie shows people that we might want to look like in their ads. But we think a lot less about, well, what might people want to avoid, right? Might people want to avoid doing something if other people are doing it? We did another study with health behavior showing people actually avoided binge drinking in college when we associated with an identity that was undesired for them. And so it's not just about associating things with desired behaviors to get people to do it. It's also about saying, well, how can we associate undesired behaviors with undesired identities and use that to avoid people doing the wrong thing?
One of the interesting ideas you explore is that social influence can have implications for innovation, because it suggests that if we are shaped by those around us, then an idea that in some ways is too far ahead or too different from the norms that we see around us might have a difficult time getting adopted. Can you tell me the story of the 1899 invention known as Horsey Horseless?
This is an amazing story that I came across while doing for research for the book. And it turns out that when automobiles came out, it's hard to remember that in today's day and age when we see automobiles all the time, but when they first came out, they were very scary. People had never seen a non-horse-driven carriage. Imagine this thing sort of almost like a ghost rolling down the street by itself. No horse pulling it, no person pulling it. People in rural areas called it the devil's work and, you know, banned it from town. And so people were trying to figure out, well, how do we get this thing adopted? It obviously saved costs in a certain way. There was a huge amount of manure on the street. So, you know, getting rid of horses was good in some ways. They could travel further. How could they get people to adopt this new innovation? And what's interesting is the challenge wasn't a functional one. It wasn't that the product didn't work. It was a psychological one. The product was fine, but they had to overcome it feeling too different. And indeed, it's a little bit like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, if you think about it, right? One end is too different. If something's too different, it's scary. We don't want to adopt it. It's too far away. If at the same time something exactly the same as what people are doing, people don't want to adopt it, right? Why do I need to change my behavior for something that's exactly the same? But in the middle is just right, is what might be called optimally distinct, if you will. And so going back to the automobile, this inventor came up with a really interesting idea to solve this problem. And he had come up with many innovations, including a desk for students and a sort of a leg cast to help people to recover after injuries. He said, God, you know, if the problem's psychological, I have an idea. So he came out with this innovation called the Horsey Horseless, which is essentially taking a fake horse head and putting it on the front of an automobile. And you look at this thing and you say, why would a fake horse head be anywhere near useful in helping people adopt an automobile? But what it did is it made the different feel more familiar, made it feel more similar, right? It was just a fake horse head, but it made it look like these vehicles that people were used to already. It made horses feel more comfortable when this thing pulled up next to them at the stop sign or the stoplight of the day, if it were. It made people feel more familiar with the difference. And so this idea of optimal distinctiveness is really important. Not so different. If it's so different, people are scared. They don't want to adopt it. It's scary. It's new. It's, you know, why do I want to do this thing? Same if it's too similar, but in the middle, and it's just right. In the middle, it's optimally distinct and much more likely to catch on.
So as I was reading this section of the book, I started thinking immediately about driverless cars and the concerns and trepidations that many people have about cars that seem to drive themselves. I mean, talk about, you know, a ghost in the machine. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, people sometimes have these mannequins that sit in the car with them to give people the impression that there's someone in the car with them. So if you're a woman driving through a city street at night and you want to give people the illusion that you're not alone in the car and you're maybe less vulnerable to crime, you have this mannequin sitting next to you. And I realized what we should do is take the mannequin and put the mannequin in the driver's seat. And if you did that, that's essentially going to be our version of Horsey Horseless.
It's almost like a taxi driver, except it's a mannequin. I love that idea. You should write to Google and Uber and suggest it. I think, but again, right, you're thinking really correctly about it. It's not a driverless car doesn't have to look like a car, right? I mean, if all it's doing is getting us from point A to point B, why does it have to look like a car? Why does it have to have a steering wheel? Any of these things. But part of it is not just the function. It's the psychology. Does it feel safe? And having someone, even if it's a mannequin, sitting in the driver's seat might make us feel more comfortable.
Coming up, we're going to explore how invisible influence affects the way we think about politics.
So the simple idea here is it's often party over policy. Even the same policy, even the same actual thing, we interpret that thing based on who's supporting it.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Duolingo, a language app whose mission is to make language learning fun and accessible to the world, with lessons in more than 30 languages, including French, Spanish, and Chinese, available in the App Store or at duolingo.com. And from C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at c3.ai.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. We're talking today with the University of Pennsylvania's Jonah Berger. Most of us believe we come to our political views after careful thought and consideration. But there's been a lot of recent social science research that shows that our views are heavily shaped by social context. Even when it comes to our understanding of the facts, we're biased by the thoughts and opinions of those around us. I asked Jonah Berger if this was part of the world of invisible influence.
A colleague of mine did a great study a few years ago looking at exactly this. So he gave both liberals and conservatives a number of different policy propositions. So one was about helping disadvantaged people, one was about taxes, a bunch of different policies. And he told them that those policies were either supported by Democrats or Republicans. What he found, very much along the lines of what you just mentioned, is that when conservatives saw a policy, the same policy, if they thought that policy was supported by conservatives, they loved the policy. They thought it was great. They supported it. Even if it was a welfare policy, even if it was a generous welfare policy, the fact that conservatives seemed to like it, the fact they were told that other conservative leaders supported it, they thought it was great. They thought it was terrible, though, if that same policy, that same liberal welfare policy was supported by liberals. Oh, the liberals, they're always doing this, you know, helpful stuff for welfare. I'm totally, totally against it. Same policy, completely different reaction. Liberals did exactly the same thing. When liberals were told that policy was supported by liberals, they loved it. When liberals were told conservatives liked the policy, they hated it. And so the simple idea here is it's often party over policy. Even the same policy, even the same actual thing, we interpret that thing based on who's supporting it, right? Based on the identity it signals. And this actually happened to me just a few months ago. So was doing a consulting project with messaging for an organization that wanted to help clean energy catch on among conservatives. And clean energy is something that they thought conservatives would support. After all, it saves tax dollars, it reduces the size of government, all things that conservatives should like. Yet when they surveyed conservatives, they found that conservatives weren't supporting clean energy. And so they dug a little deeper and they found that there was a clear reason why. When they asked conservatives, particularly conservative leaders, why conservative leaders weren't supporting the policy, they said, oh yeah, clean energy, you know, solar power, wind power, well, isn't that something that Al Gore likes? And if Al Gore likes it, it's probably not for me. And what's so interesting there again is same policy, right? Yet the mere fact that it was associated with a prominent liberal like Al Gore made them not want to do it. And so we really need to think about the politics, not just of actual politics, but the politics of identity. What does it mean to engage in a certain behavior? What does it signal about me to do something or not do something? And how can we use that to help people do better things?
I mean, there are a lot of political scientists who talk about our affiliation with political parties as being very analogous to our support for various sports teams, you know. So I'm a devout fan of a football team, and of course every year the players on that team change, and it's completely irrational to support the team when all the people playing for the team have changed. But there's a famous line from Jerry Seinfeld, you know, what we're really doing is we're rooting for laundry. And at some level we're doing that with politics too. I mean, what we're really doing is we're rooting for laundry.
I love that phrase, rooting for laundry, and certainly, you know, that's part of it, right? Part of it is it feels like a team identity. There's also some information there, right? There's this notion that, God, if a lot of people that I feel similarly to in the past like this and support this, I'm going to like it and support it too, right? If I walk by a restaurant and there's a long line out in front, I assume that restaurant must be better. Same thing with politics, right? If the party changes or, you know, the party views change, but everyone still thinks it's that same organization that they know and love, sometimes they end up following the wrong thing.
You know, a few months ago, we cited one of your other studies on Hidden Brain. It had to do with the likelihood of winning basketball games and what the score was at halftime. I have to say, I absolutely love this study. Can you tell us how you came to do the study and what it found?
I used to be a soccer coach, and this is where it actually came from. So I went to graduate school and undergrad in California at Stanford. Loved soccer growing up, and so I decided to become a coach. So I coached AYSO, sort of, you know, the little league of soccer. Coach is generous, by the way. I was basically sort of shepherding, 15, 12-year-old boys and trying to stop them from fighting for an hour and a half twice a week. But we'd run drills and we'd try to get better and, you know, hopefully they learned one or two things along the way. But when it came time to games, I noticed something weird. We were a good team. We weren't the best team out there. We were a good team. But when we were behind at halftime, we always seemed to figure out a way to win. So if we were down by a goal, we'd win 2-1. If we were down two goals even, sometimes we'd win. You know, we were down 2-0, we'd win 3-2. We always figured out a way to pull it out. And other times, though, if we were tied or we ahead, we sometimes figured out a way to lose. And so I was just trying to figure out, God, you know, what am I doing wrong? If we can come from behind, shouldn't we win all the time? So with a friend of mine, great colleague of mine named Devin Pope, he's now at the University of Chicago, we went out and got tens of thousands of professional basketball games. We got a bunch of NCAA games, a bunch of NBA games, and essentially we looked and said, okay, how does the score at halftime relate to the score at the end of the game? So how does if a team is ahead or behind at halftime affect whether or not they win or lose? Similar to my youth soccer team, except hopefully a little more data. And interesting, by the way, hopefully a little more motivated, right? If you're an NBA player, you're getting tens of millions of dollars based on your performance. So you might say, okay, you know, if you're a 12-year-old kid and your coach sort of cajoles you and encourages you to play harder, you're more likely to win. But it shouldn't matter for NBA players, right? I mean, NBA players, real big stakes, whether they win or lose, they make more or less money. Of course it doesn't matter there, right? So that's what we wanted to look at. And so we looked at the data, and similar to soccer, we saw something really interesting, which is there was one place where being behind was actually a good thing. And that was being behind by just a little bit. Teams that were down by one at halftime, they weren't more likely to lose, as everyone else would have been if they were behind. They were actually more likely to win. Teams that were down by one were more likely to win than teams that were up by one. Even though they were worse teams, down by 2 points relative to the teams that were up by one, they had to score more to win. They came out, they played harder in the second half, and they were more likely to win the game. And so it turns out that competition can affect motivation, right? How we're doing relative to others matters. And so being behind can be motivating, but only if you're behind by a little bit. If you're behind by too much, you give up and you're more likely to quit.
So I have to tell you, Jonah, that it's been a little more than a decade since I began learning about many of these studies and ideas. And, you know, I was really taken aback by many of them when I first came by them, because I think of myself as being a very rational and deliberate and intentional person. And the idea that my own actions or beliefs or judgments were being shaped by these factors that lie many cases outside my conscious awareness was sort of a really disturbing idea to me. I have to say what's interesting is that at an intuitive level, it still feels to me that all my decisions and judgments are conscious and intentional and deliberate. I don't feel the effects of social pressure, except that you look at the mountain of evidence and you have to say, if it's affecting all these other people on the planet, it must be affecting me as well. And I feel like one of the great values of this body of research is it might prompt people to a certain degree of humility, of saying, yes, I feel very strongly about the political party I support. I feel very strongly about the sports team I support. I feel very strongly about my beliefs. But it's just possible that maybe these beliefs are actually shaped by these other factors, and I might want to be a little humble about the things that I think I know. I'm wondering, as you've looked at this body of work, what's been the effect on you personally? What's been the effect on your personal life as you look at all the ways in which human beings are shaped by other people?
You know, you read this literature and you do some studies in this literature and you can almost have an existential crisis. You can say, God, you know, I'm not making any of my own choices. Other people are making all these things for me. Is there no free will? Am I just a mindless automaton? I mean, you know, take a great example, and this is something that always struck me. You know, think about the person that we marry, right? Or the person that we end up being our long-term partner, our relationship partner. You know, we all have this sense that they're perfect for us. You know, we all have this belief in true love and that we're out finding the right person out there that completes us, that, you know, the one person whose shoe perfectly fits, the one person who will make us whole. And yet, is that right? You know, is it there's the one person out there and we just have to find them? Or are we subtly being influenced by our environment? Did we like them because, you know, we saw them more often and so we got exposed to them more and so mere exposure leads to liking? You know, were we influenced by our environment or did we really make our own choice? And for a while, I think personally, that was something I struggled with a lot, thinking about, you know, well, do we really make our choices? And if we don't make our choices, what does that mean about who we are? And I'm not sure I got to a perfect answer, honestly, but I think where I ended up is you know, influence by itself is neither good nor bad. It is just a way of life. It is a thing that helps us make our lives easier. Imagine if we had to make every choice by ourselves. We couldn't use any information from others. We couldn't figure out what book to read or what movie to see. If we moved to a new town, we couldn't figure out what car mechanic to go to without looking at an online review. You know, we had to just figure it out by ourselves. Life would be extremely difficult. And so along the way, we've evolved to take advantage of social information, to use others as a heuristic or a shortcut to judgment, to make it easier to live, you know, faster and easier than it might be otherwise. Does that heuristic always lead us to the right answer? No. There are many cases, you know, some of which we've talked about, where other people lead us astray. Yet most of the time, influence is a valuable tool. And so I think the more we realize its effect on us, the more we can spot it in the environment around us, the happier and healthier we can be. We can't fully control it. You know, it's going to be there all the time. But the more we understand it, the more we can take advantage of its upsides and avoid its downsides.
Jonah Berger, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's been a pleasure having you on Hidden Brain.
Thanks so much for having me.
After the break, we look more at our behavior as consumers, how the things we buy tell stories to other people and to ourselves. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and you're listening to Hidden Brain. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, a language learning app that teaches real-life conversations. Using speech recognition technology and voiced by native speakers, daily 10 to 15-minute lessons are at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from LifeLock. LifeLock with Norton reminds consumers that cybercriminals can steal identities, sell personal information on the dark web, and even infect mobile devices with malware. Learn more at lifelock.com.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedantam. How do you spend your money? On shoes, cars, coffee, fancy restaurants? You might think you use money just to, you know, buy stuff. But it turns out the way we spend our money often says a lot about who we are and what we want to project. Neeru Paharia is a marketing professor at Georgetown University. She studies how consumer behavior often serves psychological needs, not just economic ones. When we think about the way we spend money, we may think about the comfort of a nice pair of shoes or the pleasure of a great meal. But money also serves a deeper purpose. We use money to express our feelings, to project our status, to defend our values. The products we buy tell stories to other people and to ourselves. Neeru Paharia says she first became interested in the psychological power of consumer products because of the diamond industry.
The diamond engagement ring. How else could 2 months' salary last forever? A diamond.
I studied economics as an undergraduate, and one thing they tell you as an economics major is that people are rational.
But as far as Neeru could tell, there was nothing particularly rational about buying a diamond. Now, you can argue that diamonds are beautiful, but there are cheaper stones that are just as pretty.
So then the question is, why are people spending so much money on these shiny rocks that have no intrinsic value. You know, there's effectively a perfect substitute. And then it seemed like it was all this kind of psychological stuff that people wanted to express their status. People wanted to kind of fit in with sort of the normative practices in terms of marriage. And it's just sort of dawned on me that products have all this psychological value, and that's worth real money. I mean, a whole industry is based on just sort of pure kind of signaling and psychological value. And I found that to be really interesting and sort of at odds with this notion that people are rational.
This idea made Neeru think about the other ways we use money as a signaling device to express our beliefs and our values.
We enact our political will usually by voting or supporting different kinds of legislations and things like that. So it's kind of interesting when people start taking that civic actions, these kind of civic actions into the market, and then start boycotting or boycotting a certain brand or a certain company in order to express their view. And you can kind of think about it in terms of what ends up being more tangible. So if we think about voting, it's sort of an abstract process. It's not very public. Whereas when you buy a product or avoid buying a product, it's very tangible.
If you're someone who doesn't buy flashy jewelry, you may say, okay, I'm not one of those people who uses money to talk. Maybe. Or maybe you just don't use diamonds to talk. You use coffee.
I've studied the situations between small coffee shops and large coffee shops. And so I have a paper where we show that for a small coffee shop, if it's just sitting there by itself, people don't really think much of the political situation. They just think more about the coffee, sort of about the more rational economic features and attributes of the product. But as soon as you put a large competitor in next door, say you put a Starbucks in next door, all of a sudden it becomes this fight between the little guy and the big guy. And then buying your cup of coffee is really meaningful. All of a sudden, it's a symbol of what you believe in. It's a symbol of you supporting the little guy, of you supporting the underdog and trying to stick it to the man. And it's so tangible. And I just find it so fascinating that that's sort of how we kind of express our political views on a daily basis, and we feel, you know, powerful.
Companies, of course, pay attention to what consumers want. They understand that people don't just want to buy a cup of coffee or a computer. They want the right story to go with that cup of coffee or computer. This is why so many Silicon Valley companies that are worth billions of dollars spend so much time telling us about their origin stories, how two kids dropped out of college to explore a dream in someone's garage.
So this is what we have another paper around underdog brand biographies, and the sort of idea of kind of starting in a garage from humble beginnings, but overcoming obstacles to kind of fulfill your dream. That's a really compelling narrative, especially to Americans, I think, because of the whole kind of pull yourself up from your bootstraps and this whole notion of the American dream. And so companies that take advantage of that narrative, and if they use it effectively, even as they grow, can kind of remind consumers that, you know, this was a small company and they might, you know, identify with it more and thus, you know, like penalize them less for being a large company. There tends to be sort of a kind of an aversion or a disdain for large companies. People tend to kind of identify a lot more with smaller companies.
And you tell the story of Nantucket Nectars, which also has the same sort of startup story.
A lot of companies, they talk about how Nantucket Nectars in particular talks about how they started with a blender and a dream. And Clif Bar talks about how, you know, they started in their garage with he was living with his dog and his skis and, you know, was cooking and his, you know, it's this sort of underdog narrative that makes use of this sort of external disadvantage, but really, you know, trying hard. And I think people really, really find that story resonating because I think we all on some level feel like underdogs. And so it sort of can be motivating to us.
Companies are also extremely skilled at selling us things that are tied to a certain sense of identity. I remember this set of ads that Apple was running some years ago where they basically suggested that people who bought Macs were hipper and cooler than people who bought PCs.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
I'm afraid to ask.
Well, I was sitting on my desk.
Yeah.
Someone walked by, carelessly tripped over my power cord, yanked me straight down to the ground. Bam!
Yikes. MacBooks come with this power cord that connects magnetically, so when it gets pulled, it just pops right off. Everything's just kind of thought out, you know, like the tiny built-in eyesight camera.
My life is flashing before my eyes. I see a sunset in a field of beautiful wheat.
Isn't that your screensaver?
Yeah.
They were basically saying, if you buy this kind of computer, it sends a signal of the kind of person you are. It's not so much about your status, but how cool you are.
Yeah, and I think being cool is also a form of status. You know, you wanna, and there's actually recent research on this by Warren and Campbell, and they talk about how coolness is essentially another way of kind of signaling your status, which can be very compelling to certain groups of consumers who want to signal their autonomy, that they're not just drones and just kind of following the masses, but they're autonomous, that they have kind of control and are kind of independently minded.
There is some irony here in an advertising campaign by a major company trying to convince people that if you buy products made by that company, you're actually acting independently and autonomously, when in fact the advertising is actually making you do what the company wants you to do.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I remember in high school that there was a whole group of kids who would wear Metallica shirts, and they were trying to show how different they were, but yet they were all wearing Metallica shirts, and so they were sort of defeated the purpose on some level, but it wasn't immediately apparent to them.
One thing that Niro has found is that consumers are attracted not just to high-end brands, but to powerful brands. Walmart can be a status symbol.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So there's this relationship between status and power. And so status is a way, is sort of what we get when we have power. And so when we think about power, we can think about Walmart as being a really powerful brand. It has a lot of strength in the marketplace. And so that strength, that kind of access to power, having a lot of resources as a brand in itself, even though it's kind of a low-end brand, if you compare it to other low-end brands, that can be kind of attractive to people who care about status.
Many of us understand the economic choices we make can have real ethical consequences. The products we buy can adversely affect the environment or take advantage of poor people in distant countries. We can buy stuff from stores that treat their employees well, or we can buy things, sometimes at a cheaper price, from stores that treat their employees poorly. Often, after a big news story about conditions in sweatshops or the use of child labor, there's public outrage. But as Niru Paharia has explored, our actions don't always match our rhetoric. She once wrote a paper on the subject titled, "Sweatshop Labor is Wrong Unless the Shoes Are Cute."
And the idea there is that you kind of decide how much you like something. And so you really like a pair of shoes. And so then kind of the moral reasoning starts from there. It doesn't start from kind of a neutral place where you're like, where you say, oh, sweatshop labor is wrong. You know, under any circumstances, I don't want to subject people to these unfortunate working conditions. It actually starts at a place where you're like, well, the product's really nice and the shoes look really good on me. And then you start reasoning about it. And that's called motivated reasoning. So rather than think about morality in terms of this kind of objective thing, we kind of think about it more like a lawyer. So we decide what we want, and then we kind of come up with the reasons to support it. So we may say, oh, if we see a pair of shoes that we don't like, we may say, oh, sweatshop labor is wrong. I don't like sweatshop labor. I don't approve. But if the shoes are cute, you might say something like, oh, it's okay because people need jobs or companies need to make money. So you'll be more likely to agree with these things because you're motivated. In a sense, the shoes are really cute. You really want them. And so you want to find a way to kind of reconcile your kind of distaste for this situation and the kind of the reality of it.
And you've actually conducted experiments which show that people are more likely to reach for these kinds of rationalizations when they actually like a product.
Yes, exactly. So if they like a product, if you show them sort of an attractive pair of shoes, they'll be more likely to agree with these economic justifications. If you show them an unattractive pair of shoes, all of a sudden they become these kind of moral animals who say, oh, no, it's wrong. And so so the idea is that we just decide what is moral based on, you know, how much we want something.
One thing you've looked at is that we're often willing to go along with products that are ethically problematic so long as we can come up with a way to distance ourselves from the unethical behavior that produced it. That the more distance we can put between ourselves and the unethical behavior or the unethical action, the easier it becomes to perform. So this goes to the idea that if I went to the grocery store and asked for a chicken and they went out and killed a chicken for me, I would feel worse about that than if I was just picking up the chicken from a tray. And of course, in both cases, a chicken had to be killed. But in one case, I feel like I have actually asked for the chicken to be killed. In the other case, the dirty work has already been done.
Yeah. So there's a number of things that sort of enable us to not feel so close to the harm. I mean, essentially, you're buying a product from a company, but what you're doing is you're hiring them to do kind of this dirty work for you. So say any clothing company, they're the ones who hire, you know, a child and maybe, you know, under some unfortunate conditions, you're not directly actually hiring that person. But I think the second thing that happens is this idea of the order of how kind of supply and demand happens. So we live in an economy where most items are produced first. And so they're already produced, they're already in the store. And so when you go to the store, the damage has been done, so to speak. So it's already been done, it's already happened. But imagine that you went into that same store and you had to order your chicken or your clothes on demand. So if you order it on demand, you know, they will put a child, you know, have them work under these unfortunate conditions. And then you start feeling responsible and guilty for this situation where when it's already happened, you feel like, oh, well, it's already happened and I'm not responsible for it. And I think people don't really kind of see this broader role that consumers have in creating demand for these kinds of products. They don't see that A causes B because it sort of happens backwards, that they actually make the product first and then you decide if you want it. But if we lived in an economy that was all on demand, then it would happen the other way. You would decide you want it and then they would make it. And then there would be a stronger connection, kind of a stronger cause and effect connection that I think people would then feel a bit more responsible and a bit more guilty for these kinds of situations.
I can imagine that people would feel horrible if they said, I want a shirt, and they have to send some poor 9-year-old kid into the basement to make the shirt for the next 6 hours. I mean, people would feel awful about that.
Yeah, and I think people wouldn't do it. And so then it kind of gets to this question of, does the economic structure and the structure of how goods are made, does the kind of logistical structure impact how we think about ethics and how we think about our own role in enabling these kinds of harms?
The companies who make stuff for us are run by people, and those people have minds that work like our minds. So it should come as no surprise that just as consumers would rather have companies do the dirty work for them to distance themselves from the ethical consequences of their economic actions, companies often choose to do exactly the same thing. Rather than run a factory that makes clothing under awful working conditions, why not outsource the dirty work to someone else? If a reporter unearths details of poor working conditions, you can now plausibly say, "But I didn't know about it."
In many cases, companies actually do outsource the harm. So rather than own the factory that makes the clothing under, you know, these terrible conditions, we outsource them to other firms that are owned by other entities. So a lot of these companies do try and claim that they had no knowledge of this. This did not happen within the boundaries of my firm.
It turns out that both individuals and companies often prefer to be kept in the dark about unethical practices that are further up the supply chain.
So there was a really, really interesting paper by Julie Irwin and some other colleagues who wrote a paper on this idea of willful ignorance. And the idea was that you had a product and you had access to a whole bunch of different pieces of information. And one of them was the labor conditions or the environmental conditions. And the question was, do people actually ask for this information? You can look at it if you want, but you could decide not to look at it. And it turns out people didn't want to look at that information because they didn't really want to be confronted with this kind of conflict between their beliefs and you know, what they really wanted. And they found this effect was stronger for people who cared more about labor issues, who cared more about environmental issues, they were more likely to avoid, you know, avoid this information in order to kind of avoid this conflict.
Think of the deep irony of what Nehru just said. The folks who care the most about ethics might be most willing to turn a blind eye to unethical business practices because they know if they found out about those practices, they would feel obliged to do something about it. We've talked about the many ways in which consumers and companies play games with one another, using products to speak on their behalf or using products behind which they can hide. But there's one dimension of economic activity we haven't explored, and that's time. I asked Nehru how some of us use our calendars to broadcast our social status. It used to be that people once broadcast their social status by being idle. But that idea has been turned on its head in the United States.
It turns out nowadays that people who are busy are actually seen to have more social status. So rather than somebody who is very wealthy, who could waste their time, take fancy vacations, you know, invest in learning these kind of archaic mannerisms, it turns out the person who works really hard, who's really busy, who's very effortful, is the one who's seen to have more social status. And I think in part, that is because we live in a society that values social mobility. So we actually conducted the study in the U.S. and we conducted the same study in Italy. And we found that for Italian people, they thought the person who was living a life of leisure had more status. Of course, they have so much money, they can just relax all the time. Whereas in the U.S., they thought the person who was working all the time actually had more status. And I think what was going on was that in the U.S., people sort of value this sense of earned status. So status can be earned in the U.S., where I think in Italy, it's more of a society where status is inherited. So for example, my co-author is Italian, and she's always talking about how people come from good families or not. And so there's very much this idea that your status isn't necessarily something that you earn, but you inherit. And so in that sense, working hard really wouldn't get you anywhere. Whereas in America, you have the sense that you can actually climb the ladder.
And so celebrities, for example, might say, instead of saying, you know, I make one movie every year and I get to hang out on the beach for the other 10 months of the year, they actually are suggesting, oh, my God, I'm so overworked.
Yeah. So we actually looked at tweets of celebrities who were tagged with this hashtag humble brag, this idea of bragging, but sort of disguising it as a complaint. And a lot of the tweets we found had to do with being busy. So, you know, I have to be in the recording studio this morning, and then I have a book meeting in the afternoon, and then I have to travel to New York in the evening, and hashtag I have no life, you know. These kinds of tweets, you're trying to say something about yourself. You're busy. You're really important. You don't have time to do other things. And so you see that on social media. That's kind of an acceptable and effective way to show your status by telling people how busy you are.
Nehru, I want to ask about your own life, which is, I understand that growing up, you came from a family that in some ways prized not demonstrating its commitment to status, that actually prized not buying the expensive things as a way to show off.
I'm of East Indian origin, and my parents immigrated to this country. And it turns out in East Indian communities, showing your social status is a very, very important thing. So people are really, really motivated to show their status. And when I was growing up, that was happening through buying, you know, really expensive cars. So a lot of my parents' friends, they had Jaguars and they had Mercedes. And I remember I went to a friend's house one time and they had a Jaguar. She was also Indian. And I asked her, she was complaining about her mom kind of being frugal about different things. And I said, oh, that's so strange because, you know, she's frugal and yet you have a Jaguar. And she said, oh, well, that's just to show off. And I just, the candidness of that moment really, really, you know, sparked something in my mind. Like, wow, people are just trying to show off. And my mom also would often complain about how all her friends would buy these expensive cars and the only reason they were doing it was to show off. And so I kind of got really fascinated with this idea of showing your social status. And I think kind of an evidence of how things are shifting now towards something like busyness. Now all her friends are retired, and they all brag about how busy they are. And now my mom complains about how everyone talks about how busy they are all the time. So I think, you know, it's sort of an evolving mechanism.
Neeru Paharia is a marketing professor at Georgetown University. Neeru, thank you for joining me today on Hidden Brain.
Thanks for having me.
This week's episode was produced by Maggie Penman, Tara Boyle, and Laura Quirrell. Our team includes Jenny Schmidt, Raina Cohen, Parth Shah, and Thomas Liu. For more Hidden Brain, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like this episode, please tell one friend about it and help them subscribe to our show. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and this is NPR.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from the George and Faye Young Foundation. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Babbel, an interactive language program that teaches travel, business, and casual conversation skills in a new language, like Spanish. Available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And from the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story, and favorite NPR shows become exclusive wines, like Weekend Edition Primitivo, available to adults 21 years or older, nprwineclub.org.